Hello and welcome back to the interview by IMD, where some of the brightest minds in business, investing and tech share their thoughts on the future. Today, Jim Pulcrano, IMD's Adjunct Professor of Entrepreneurship and Management, is interviewing Rashita Sinha, who leads healthcare and investing at AV8. AV8 got off the ground in 2018 and is backed by a single LP, Allianz, one of Europe's largest insurers. With a diversified approach, AV8 invests across three key verticals: healthcare and life sciences, enterprise tech, and financial services, bringing in industry experts to lead in each sector. After successfully raising their first fund, they followed up with a second in 2021, bringing their total assets under management to just under $400 million.
The core thesis of the fund at AV8 is to invest in early applications of data and AI that are fundamentally transforming different industries. So majority of the time, we are focusing in vertical AI and vertical data companies. So I lead the healthcare and life sciences vertical, and we do mostly early stage investing. So we're doing pre-seed, seed, series A. And the way I think about the healthcare and life sciences is two sub-verticals within that umbrella. And that is primarily because life science companies have a very different risk-reward profile than health tech or digital health companies. And so we like to come in from the life sciences side, early stage check, but platform-focused companies, so companies that have some aspect of computation AI in their platform, and they are looking to apply that to either a biotech application, therapeutic application, or diagnostic application. And that way, having a platform gives you multiple shots on goal for that. On the health tech side, we are looking at either tech-enabled service companies or pure software companies that are changing either cost, quality, or access of care within healthcare.
You have both an MBA and training as a molecular biologist and in biochemistry. What made you decide to use this knowledge in investing? And why are you doing what you're doing, basically?
It's been a path of exploring my passion and building on it to land on the one that I currently have, and I really enjoy it. So the consistent theme that has been prominent in my career is just a love of science, which started in the early days, and it was love of biology because my mom always wanted me to be a doctor. So really, it started from that, but the love of science and biology stuck. And when I saw science being applied to developing therapies early on in my career, that was just a hook that I wanted to continue being involved in it in some way or the other. So started off my career as a scientist, was on the early side of drug development, so obviously research side, and then eventually transitioned onto the commercial side. So I saw how big pharma develops drugs and gets them over to the patients. And having seen that, then I landed upon being an investor. I look at investing in early stage companies is instead of committing to one company and getting that therapy over to patients or helping care being delivered to patients, I help a number of companies in my portfolio do that simultaneously. That helps me convince myself is a bigger impact, but it also keeps me on my toes and is intellectually very challenging.
So what personal qualities give your LP confidence in your role as an investor?
When things are going well, everyone's happy and everyone's job is easy. It's really when things are not going well that defines the character and the long-term sustainability of an investor. And so that's what I would say helps me is the ability to really kind of help get through tough situations with companies, which in early stage investing happens a lot, and be able to pull the team together and work together to get through hard times. So there are a couple of different aspects that I feel help me. One, having a lot of patience, which I've learned from having kids mostly. Having open lines of communication with not only my entrepreneur and my founding team, but also co-investors. When you're going through a tough situation, maybe people come to the table with very different incentives and very different objectives. And sometimes that may or may not align between investors and entrepreneurs. And so how do you reach across the table to make sure you get to some sort of an agreement on the outcome of a company is very important. So I think those are some of the qualities that help me in terms of navigate the tough sides and also help me prioritize. Because ultimately, as an investor, where you should be focusing most of your time and energy are on your winners. What invariably ends up happening is you end up spending most of your time on the companies that are struggling. And so having that realization that ultimately you're an investor, you're not the founder of a company, and be able to make the decisions of letting go and walking away from a hard situation sometimes where maybe the juice is not worth the squeeze.
When you're listening to an initial pitch from an entrepreneur, assuming it seems to fit your investment thesis, what are danger signals that will tell you to pass? Or the other way around, what would be the things that would get you to say, I'd like a second meeting?
Yeah, there are many, many, I guess, signals. Maybe if I could distill it down to maybe three things. One is being an early stage investor, I think close to 90% of our conviction is driven by the team, because the company most likely goes through a number of different pivots between the time we invest in the company and the time that the second financing comes along or the company's ready to graduate from us being very heavily involved. And so at that point, because of that, having a close relationship with the founders and making sure that's a trusting relationship is important. So the first category of characteristics are really related to the personality of the founder and how the founder presents themselves. So things like coming across as too arrogant or knowing it all is tough, because who wants to work with a person like that? Coming across as not deep enough and not being intellectually honest. So as we look at companies, sometimes we do become experts in certain areas because we've spoken to 5 or sometimes 10 companies in that space. And so if we scratch a little bit deeper under the surface, and that's when a founder starts losing their confidence and their knowledge base, it's an important signal, right? An important signal around how committed that person is to that idea and how much time they've spent thinking about that idea. So those are a couple of examples around specifically the founder. The second category would be the team. Mm-hmm. So the type of people a founder chooses to surround themselves with is a very big indicator of who the founder is, right? And so thinking about supplementing the gaps in your own skill set and showing that in how you build the team is actually a very important indication of self-realization, right? And being intellectually honest. And so that's another thing that we like to see. Sometimes we do see single founders of companies where they haven't even built a team. However, they probably have folks that are helping them, either as advisors or as part-time workers, consultants. And so even that is a very important indication. And then the third aspect is really the storytelling. So that becomes very important, because obviously the story you tell not only talks about how important differentiated your technology is, but also how you think about monetizing it and what you plan to do with it. Now, again, that may not end up being the final path of the company, but how you think about that story is very important, because storytelling is one of the biggest things you do as a founder of a company.
Excellent. It wasn't on the list of questions, but do you ever lead a round, or are you always joining a round?
We do both. Okay. So we do lead rounds. However, our check sizes are, you know, typically smaller, so up to $5 million. And so because of that, the round has to be a decent size where we can buy ownership. Otherwise, it's better for us to join as a syndicate member, but we are open to doing both.
How do you assess if an entrepreneur is potentially a great company builder and not just a good founder?
This is something that I have been thinking a lot about, and this is something that you consistently refine your internal models, that you build your own mental models as you look at the data coming out of your investments. And so I was just thinking about this yesterday, and I don't have a very strong answer. I'm not sure I know this definitively, whether there are here 2 or 3 things that I look for. I do know repeat founders, and when I compare them to first-time founders, the level of self-realization is on a whole different level. So I tend to take that as a very important indication, is when you spend time with the founder, is the founder talking about people and team and those aspects of the company enough, versus their technology and what am I going to do? My technology is the best in the world. And that sometimes works really well in the early years to be that technology focused. But really, does it translate into building a long-term sustainable company? Probably not. Because sometimes you're screening in entrepreneurs, the qualities you're screening for are really not that of a company builder. You're screening for a company starter, right? Mm-hmm. So things like how much hustle a person has, how driven they are, how well they present to investors. These are some of the qualities everybody looks at. How charismatic are you? And most of those do not translate into a person becoming a good leader, right? And so I think that's where just having more of a longer term view when you are taking that initial couple of meetings is very important. And then we also, part of our process is to do very thorough reference checks. And this is cold and hot reference checks. And if you talk to 10, 15 people who know a person, you get a pretty good view of that person. And you will invariably pick up signals. The question is, do you pay attention to those signals or not? Because I have done deals where the signals were always there. I just didn't pick up on it. I just didn't prioritize it. And a few years down the road, it just came up very blatantly. And it was, but it was there all along.
So how do you make sure that you listen to these? So coming back to healthcare, the human body and biology moves at a different speed than the capital markets. How do you square this with your LP's expectations? And you could even go further and say, what KPIs do you expect from your founders?
So I think it's a little bit different on the health tech side or digital health side versus if you're doing diagnostics or biotech. So health tech companies are a little bit easier because they tend to work more like technology companies, although a little bit slower because just sales cycles in healthcare are longer. And it's sometimes products are regulated, so it makes your development cycles longer too. So I think that's a little bit more clear cut where your signals are, you allow a few years for product development, and then it's all commercial from there on. Where it gets more tricky is on the biotech side, if you're developing drugs. And however, the biotech VC landscape has been around for a while, so these things have been programmed now, and it's based on there are market-driven milestones that you look at. And so it's a question of really educating your LPs about those milestones and what leads to those inflection points. So you're not looking in biotech, you're not looking for product approval milestone because that's probably 8 to 10 years down the road. You're looking for that program getting into the clinic maybe, right? Or getting, even before that, getting some sort of animal data. So there are well-defined flagpoles or points you put along the journey, which is very long, where you say, if we get to this point, this company hits an inflection point and the value really increases by a few fold. And that's when the next round of financing happens. For biotech companies, we are mostly measuring based on what types of step-ups we can get in future financing rounds.
You just triggered another question in my head is, previously you worked with Sanofi. Now you've got a German insurance company as your investor. How do you look at the European side versus what you're living right here in Silicon Valley? Do you see vast differences or do they understand what you're living here?
Yeah, I think they understand. They don't know the frantic pace of it. So when I was at Sanofi, I was based out of Boston, but really the headquarters are in Paris. So they understand drug development really well. And to some extent, drug development is one of those unique industries where it doesn't matter where you're located, the standards are still the same. You still do similar clinical trials. Where it becomes a little bit more frantic in Silicon Valley is how, in the early stages, how do you develop products and how do you leverage technology, AI, computation to just cut that development lead time by a few fold, right? And so that, I think, is something that Silicon Valley has really perfected, and there's a playbook, and there's a ton of help out there. But after a certain point, really, it's the same. Once you get in drug development, once you get in the clinic, it's the same anywhere around the world. So I think it's a good partnership. And also there are the flip sides of Silicon Valley, too much hype and just a lot of overvaluation and things, really high expectations, which can be met. And so sometimes it's good to have counterparties across the ocean where things can be a lot more realistic.
I like that. Last question. This was inspired by something you said yesterday. You mentioned to me that success for a VC is not just the companies you pick or the deals you win, but also how well you exit. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. This is something that I've been focused on more and more as my investing career has progressed. So what defines an investor ultimately is how much money you make for your fund or for yourself, whichever you're doing. And investing in the right companies is only one part of that. There are many other parts after you invest that are equally important, if not more important. And so finding the right companies, obviously very important. Going on from there at the stage at which we invest, working very hands-on with those companies to help them find product market fit, equally important, because if they're not able to do that, nothing comes after that. And then they're off to the races, they raise more capital. But then trying to figure out how do I exit companies at the right time if an exit opportunities come up. So Aviate has had 5 exits and some of them have been early. And at that point, you decide you want to exit versus wait for a bigger outcome potentially down the road. And what are the factors at play at that point? These are some of the most critical decisions you can make. And that could be the difference between your fund returner versus not, right? And so I think those are some of the most important factors come after you've made the investment. And again, there doesn't seem to be a playbook for it because every company is unique and every situation is unique. So you continue to hone your internal models and your thesis as you move along.
Thanks for listening to the interview by IMD. If you want to learn more about Rashita and Aviate Ventures, you can go to aviate.vc. And if you want to learn more about IMD and our courses or find out about the work of Jim Pulcrano, go to imd.org. We'll see you next time.